Did you know that most of the dishes in Tom Colicchio's craft restaurant are made in made-in pots and pans? The braised short ribs, made in made-in. The Rohan duck, made in made-in. The heritage pork chop, you got it. Made in made-in, which isn't surprising. Made-in has been supplying top chefs and restaurants with high-end cookware for years for the simple reason that made-in makes exactly what demanding chefs are looking for. Their carbon steel cookware, for example, combines the best of cast iron and stainless clad, gets super hot, and is rugged enough for grills or an open flame. Best of all, Made In is sold online, so the professional grade cookware is far more affordable than other high-end brands. If you want to take your cooking to the next level, remember what so many great dishes on menus all around the world have in common. They're made and Made In. Save up to 25% this Memorial Day from the 18th until the 27th. Visit madeincookware.com. That's M-A-D-E-I-N cookware.com. Please check it out.
Bienvenidos. That's California for welcome to the April 29th edition of National Review's Radio Free California podcast. I'm Will Swaim, president of the California Policy Center. You can find my colleagues and me at californiapolicycenter.org. You can find my friend and co-host David Bonson right here. He's an economist, the host of the Capital Record podcast, the author of Full-Time Work and the Meaning of Life. That's a book. And of course, he's founder of the eponymous investment firm, the Bonson Group. Hello, David.
Hello, Will. This is our last time in person for a little while.
Ah, that makes me very sad. Where are you going next? Back to New York?
Well, I am, but I have to go to Florida tomorrow for some business middle of this week, and then I will be back in the city by the end of the week.
Are you excited?
I am missing the city, yeah.
Now, if I can ask, part of the family's out there, is that correct?
Yes, and normally Julie and I are traveling together, but we moved to a new apartment in the city, and so she went earlier this time and had me stay longer in California than both I normally do and that I really want to, but because she didn't want me there when we were moving into the new apartment because I get in the way.
So, not you.
No, actually, I really don't. I don't have any opinions on any of that kind of stuff, but it just she's good at this. She wanted to kind of run that and get everything situated and then have me kind of roll in and have all my suits in the closet, if you will.
This sounds like a great bargain to me. Let's start with speaking of suits. Here's the headline from the San Francisco Chronicle a couple of days ago. Thieves snatch Representative Adam Schiff's luggage in San Francisco. He gives dinner speech without a suit. Just a huge headline. But it is kind of funny, and you can appreciate why the Chronicle wanted this story. Adam Schiff shows up at a sort of a fundraising pitch of a couple of about 10 days ago, I guess now at this point. But his car is broken into and thieves swipe the bags from his car while it's in a downtown parking garage. That means that he, from the story, got stuck at a fancy dinner party in his shirt sleeves and a hiking vest while everyone else sat in suits. Oh, the horror. But of course, it's just the contradiction of Adam Schiff and crime and Democrats who run the state. It's a straw man. It's a nut-picking story, as you might say.
Yeah, it is.
But I
kind of feel bad because I saw that story and I got a pop-up from like Daily Wire and I go, here we go. And then yeah. I just knew the whole right-wing sort of thing was going to run with this. And it's fine. I mean, the left just begged for it. Like,
sure.
Even someone who is always constantly trying to, you know, take the high road. Mm. Like, I mean, even, I know that this stuff is just inevitable. What I didn't want is the conspiracy stuff. Like when Pelosi's husband got held up and we found out it was all fake and a gay tryst and all the other stupid stuff we had to hear. But in this case, I just figured, I know for sure people are going to say like, oh, well, you know, this is what happens when you... So it is what it is. But then I was wondering, I wonder if Will's going to bring it up.
Sorry, man. Yeah. My closest brush with this kind of disaster is when Delta loses my bags, which seems to happen somewhat routinely. In other news that we did not cover at the time, and I'll tell you why, because I thought it was also a kind of a nut-picking story, and I mean nut in the sense of insane. Here's the headline. New charges for protester charged with threatening Bakersfield council members and staff. You might remember this story, David, from a couple of weeks ago. It was just about everywhere, but I didn't put it on the podcast because I felt like it was quite clear this young woman is a little crazy.
You're referring to Riddhi Patel,
age 28? Yes. And then it turns out she's crazy because she's been indoctrinated and works with a kind of very progressive organization for whom identity and race are of such real importance in America that almost any kind of outrage is okay, as we see on our college campuses. She is, as you say, Riddhi Patel, 28, was originally charged with 10 counts of threatening with intent to terrorize and 8 counts of threatening public officials. After her April 10th comments at a public meeting, she said, "We'll see you at your house. We'll murder you." Now, here's why I do think this story is interesting. And it's not so much that she said that, but that the left's reaction in Bakersfield has been like, oh, come on, now this is just the excess of somebody got into the passion of the moment. But we're old enough to remember, because we do this podcast, that it was just a year or two ago when our state attorney general was warning city officials and school board officials that any angry parent was subject to removal immediately because they were a threat not only to the public officials, but to democracy itself. So in those instances, it was parents saying things like, you know, you got to open our schools, you got to let the kids back in and stop teaching them crap. And this was too far for Newsom, Bonta, Attorney General Merrick Garland, you might remember, David, in October of 2021, sends out a national message. He's going to bring the FBI in and have them investigate angry parents. I was at some of these meetings.
Well, and those parents said they were going to come to their house and murder them, right?
No.
No, they explicitly said the words?
No, these parents
Oh, they didn't.
They did not.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, you get where I'm going.
I do, but here's the thing. When the Sarah Palin ad had the bullseye and they go, see, she caused that, Arizona movie theater or Colorado movie theater,
yeah.
And they said, well, this is from the heated rhetoric of Sarah Palin because she ran an ad with a bullseye on it.
Right.
You know, so there are things like that are just ridiculous and perfectly within the hyperbole and just expression of stuff that gets said. And, you know, Trump's thing, he didn't even say it a few weeks ago, but the deal about it'd be a bloodbath, and he was talking about the auto industry, and they said he's threatening violence. So this is kind of the rules now. And I find myself increasingly not interested in taking the right side on different things when I think they act like boneheads. But this is just the left being such putrid hypocrites. I can't stand it. Now, I'm not going to go to their house and do anything bad because that's not really the way I roll, dog.
No.
But here's the thing. They will make a mountain out of a molehill when someone did not say it.
Right.
This gal explicitly said it.
Yes.
And then this is my favorite part. Okay, so they bring her up on the charges and, you know, she's going to plea it down and get probation or whatever.
Right.
But in the meantime, she's ordered to stay 500 yards away from all the homes.
Yes.
500 yards away from City Hall North and South. You know what? Why don't we get her a job out of town?
Yeah, maybe.
Like send her on a 500-mile trip somewhere else. Because this is completely deranged behavior. She's not, this isn't nutpicking. This is in public discourse at a city council. This was not a metaphor. It was not poetic. It was not a tweet. She looked at them. We're coming to your house and we're going to murder you.
Yes.
What are we even talking about here?
We're talking about a progressive whose passions just got the better of her.
I would say you can't ever come to city council meeting again, but that would be a reward.
Yeah. I laid the story out so terribly because I should have said that what really had her, I was going to say on fire, but that's probably also bad, was that the council just refused to take a stand on the Israel-Hamas fight and said, you know, basically, not our writ, not our job. We got problems to deal with here in Kern County. And that just set her off. So, there you go. Speaking of Hamas and progressive groups, I just sent this to you, David. I hope you were able to take a look at it. This is this flyer that's now circulating, sponsored by UTLA. That's United Teachers Los Angeles. It's a bunch of groups, progressive groups, who are going to get together at MacArthur Park, I think it says, on May 1st, May Day. And UTLA is among those who are calling for an end to colonialism. It's very anti-Israel. It's got a lot of Hamas, pro-Hamas messaging in it. And it's about socialism. It is the most delightful confluence, delightful, maybe in air quotes, but for those of us who follow these things, it's Marxist ideology meets identity politics meets anti-Semitism.
just kind of generic, right?
Yeah.
Far left?
Yeah.
Okay, so what, I'm holding the flyer, and listeners can't see what I'm holding. But, you know, stuff like abolish colonial borders, that's standard. These guys, these are big British fans here. General, I assume when they go stop the U.S. war machine, they want, they want us to, it was an anti-revolutionary war?
That's right.
Okay.
They recall them loyalists.
Free Palestine now, no big deal, stop the occupation. Mm-hmm. I assume they want to, you know, stop any money to Israel.
Mm-hmm.
Defend free speech, workers' right, media bias, genocide. They love Cuba, Venezuela, Nicaragua, Haiti. Oh, stop intervention in Haiti.
Yeah.
No more, aid, no more humanitarian aid. I got a strong feeling that's not what they mean. So all of this is vanilla stuff. But then there's one sign.
Tell me.
Trump and Biden are no solution.
Yes.
Solidarity and revolution. This is a radical left-wing Marxian labor union that is basically down the line vanilla with the current state of affairs.
Yeah,
with an anti-Biden hit. That's the only thing that stuck out to me on this. And the fact that, they're all wearing masks.
Yeah.
So they're afraid of COVID.
I guess. Or identification.
Wow.
Yeah, I think what's fascinating to me about all this is that people frequently ask me, like, my gosh, how did this happen on the college campuses? And David, I don't know if you remember this, but in this, you were pretty young, but in the 60s, 70s, 80s, even into the early maybe 90s, there was this part of academic history called psychohistory, psychoanalytic application of psychoanalysis to history. And you got these really fascinating analyses of, like, well, why did Germans become so open to fascism and Hitler, and it's because their fathers were all killed in World War One. I think there's a deeper problem in Germany than that, but that was the, I think, superficial psychoanalytic look. And you have this, you got to wonder about kids right now on college campuses who grow up with 9/11, 2008, Great Recession. They grow up with a lot of political tumult in the air, and then you get 2020, which I think for a lot of kids in college right now was a significant year. The COVID lockdowns kept them at home, shut down the schools. And then you get this George Floyd summer in which adults curiously turn to their children and say, it's never okay to steal or destroy things or hurt people unless you're really angry and have a high-level political ideology to make that okay. So we get, you know, a complete pass for Black Lives Matter riots all over the country, mostly peaceful protests. And then these kids get into college and they're rattled. We had on the show in 2021 or two, I did an interview with Mark McDonald, a psychiatrist from LA who wrote a terrific book. I need to find that one again and put it in the show notes. But it was about the impact on the kids. He's a child psychologist or psychiatrist, and he was seeing children coming out of COVID who had just been ripped apart by their parents' inaction, unwillingness to defend them, except mask them up and keep them away from strangers because strangers are going to kill you with this terrible disease. So it's not a huge surprise, I think, that we got a lot of kids who are kind of confused out there on the college campuses. If they come up with United Teachers of LA teaching them this kind of garbage, David, it's not a huge shock that they would think that rioting and insurrection are their primary means of communication.
Yeah, you know, I kind of think you're right. I've always thought that one of the things that we're going to deal with as a society is not the fear-mongering the parents put into the kids, but rather that there was about a three-year period where I suspect what most kids saw was total hypocrisy. Mm-hmm. That they said, you can't go to school, you got to wear a mask. If we go to this restaurant, you got to hide under a table and crawl, and otherwise you're going to kill every grandma in the world. Mm. And then like the mom and dad, surely in their own lives, were like, this is BS, and just living it up and doing the thing. Because that's the thing, is other than a few, very few true believers who are themselves borderline deranged in their delusion, my biggest critique was not the bad science, it was the hypocrisy, right? Mm-hmm. And I think, I wonder if kids got mixed messages from that. But you're kind of referring to the fact that in some cases, the kids actually got the fear-mongering and then now enter adult life with this sort of deranged view of things. And so, yeah, the COVID moment kind of distorted, I don't want to just say sociopolitics, but really our engagement with culture in a lot of ways. And then you add to it that, as you know, as a former 60s radical yourself and a byproduct of a punk rock movement, a lot of this is this pathology is ingrained in sinful humans. Like, I just think people like to be rebellious and just, I'm mad as hell, you know.
Yes.
To me, it's a revolutionary spirit. It's a reactionary spirit, but not in the American Revolution sense. And it's a French revolutionary spirit.
Yes.
And that's part of the human condition.
Well, it's funny you mention that because, you know, I, like most undergrads and graduate students, I read St. Augustine's Confessions. And there's the story in there. Remember the story about the pears that he steals from a neighbor's?
Yes, I do.
Oh, do you really?
Of course.
Oh, my gosh. See, when I say this, most people are like, who's Augustine? The city in Florida.
You need new friends.
I do. Well, I've got one. He's right here. So, yeah, the story.
I lead with that. I talk to people. What did you think of City of God? And they go, what's that? And I said, do you read Augustine? And they said, no. And then I say, I'm done talking to you. It's very simple. That's why I've been able to get my list down from about 200 to around 31.
Uh-huh. Well, do you want to tell the pear story or shall I?
Go ahead.
All right. So St. Augustine recounts the fact that when he was a little kid, he steals a bunch of pears, he and some friends, from a neighbor's orchard. And they eat what they can, stuff themselves late at night, and then hurl the rest of them to a bunch of pigs. And he says, why did we do this? Why did we steal these pears from a neighbor who had done us no harm? Was it because we were hungry? No, of course we weren't hungry. We were fed well in our own homes. Was it because we didn't have pears? No, everybody grew pears. We had our own pears. So why did we do it? We did it because it was wrong. We did it because we could. It was, in fact, just as you said, it is in the nature of humans sometimes to do something purely for its evil purpose, not because it serves some other definable material end, but just the good feeling of, you know, as you said, punk rock is kind of about that.
You know, you have way too much on the agenda for us to go down a sort of Protestant Catholic divide right now. And I have become so incredibly ecumenical and appreciative of many of my Catholic friends and certain elements of Catholic social thought. But this really is the dividing line. I think for myself as a more mature, almost 50-year-old Protestant, from my friends in Rome, it used to always be the way I was raised around the solas and around justification. But for me, it really is about natural law and natural theology. I just don't think that Thomistic teaching, and of course, for those who are unfamiliar with Augustine, you may also be unfamiliar with Aquinas, because they do tend to kind of have built off of each other, and Aristotle before Augustine, I should say. But I think that Aquinas vastly underappreciated the effects of sin on the human condition, that I don't think by nature we can derive a very comprehensive system of ethics, that in fact our very relationship with nature was polluted by sin, evidenced by people that would behave like this and evidenced by people that would just steal for the sake of stealing. I think that there's a different theological framework in Protestantism about what the effects of original sin were.
I wish we had more time for that right now, so we'll have to do that. Seriously.
Right now, if this were live radio, we'd be breaking the internet. I just mixed up some technological mediums.
No, but I understand.
People, like Augustine, then people start calling their friends, and then we go original sin, and people are like, you got to come listen to this. Yeah. It'd be fun someday to do a podcast where we kind of find out how the actual popular people do stuff.
Yeah. Well, I think...
because I do know it's not how we do it.
But let me ask you one question, because... I sincerely want to know. My own sense is, I'm right now listening to Winston Churchill's Audible book, not his, but I mean, yes, it's his book read by somebody else who sounds remarkably like Churchill himself. And it is just a remarkable read about the origins of World War II. And you are meeting such people of monumental evil in this story, not just Hitler, but Stalin and others. And there's just a quality there of just evil for evil's sake, getting things just because you want them and taking them from others and destroying people and being perfectly happy to do this. Is there something you're saying that's inherently more Protestant than Catholic, perhaps, in that idea that there are people out there who are just wandering the surface of the earth in search of souls they can consume?
Yeah, and I think Catholics and Protestants alike would say that sin does allow for monsters. I happen to believe that monsters is more the default position. You know, I don't think there's an exception to the rule. Like when you hear about a good sinner, like someone who is not saved, is not come to understand the expectations of righteous living, and they just choose to mostly be a good neighbor and whatnot. I view that person as kind of, well, why, right? They're again, there's a concept called common grace that I think explains a lot of it. But I think that what I'm referring to is what you said about nature, the kind of intuition. Why would someone go steal the pears for no apparent benefit? Because people are just wired for that kind of thing as in a post-lapsarian context. That's the answer. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that there is embedded in nature an ethical construct, because I think nature was polluted by sin.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I didn't mean to go down the Thomist path. You got me a picture of the great Abraham Kuyper. I think some of his work in sort of post-Reformation thought is the best work out there at kind of laying out a systematic explanation of how we think about these things in Protestantism, and particularly in Calvinism, compared to Catholic thought. But I'm appreciative of so much the work of Aquinas, and as Protestants go, I do work very hard to be more ecumenical about this, but this is the one area I've never really been able to wrap my arms around. And when I see these banshees at the UTLA, I just think, those Catholics don't get it.
All right. Moving right along. Big story. Let me see if I can do this in a proper kind of chronology. So everybody knows, you and I have been talking about this for a couple of years now. This was AB 257, the Fast Food Act. This is the one in which the state decided that fast food workers are notoriously underpaid and exploited and therefore need a $20 an hour minimum wage. They finally lured in the fast food industry to a kind of a compromise deal. And as part of those negotiations with the fast food industry, SEIU, the Service Employees International Union, was basically appointed mediator of all these conversations between lawmakers who had crafted the bill and the fast food industry. SEIU's stake in this thing was they want to unionize all these fast food workers and have never been able to. So they bring these two groups together and they force them, we now know, thanks to Ashley Zavala, KCRA up in Sacramento area, great reporter, as always. She's the one who broke the story that SEIU demanded that everybody sign non-disclosure agreements, NDAs. Now, this is fascinating for a whole bunch of reasons, because what has come out of this law, now we know, was Panera Gate. That's Panera Bread. And the idea that one of Gavin Newsom's top donors, the CEO of Panera, if you haven't seen these restaurants in your neighborhood, pay close attention, that they had been given an exemption based on arguably that they make bread in these facilities. So there's kind of a weird carve out. Fast food places accept those that make bread. And this applied specifically to just one business, it seemed, that's Panera, and they were exempted. So everybody wants to know, like, well, how did that happen? Well, the bill's author said he wasn't invited into these final negotiations where NDAs were required as a part of the participation. So good old Vince Fong from Kern County, who's an assemblyman up there and now running for Congress to take Andrew McCarthy's vacant seat. Vince Fong proposed that no NDA should ever be allowed to cover the crafting of legislation. That just seems like so obvious. It violates what we call the Brown Act. Not going to go into that. But it's basically that you have to make these kinds of decisions out in public. And when I mentioned this to a business friend of mine who said, what was I exercised about these days? I pointed out this NDA thing is a non-starter. Like we cannot allow this to ever happen again. He said, well, you know, sometimes we business people have to go into negotiations and sign NDAs because we're revealing sensitive information. And I said, if you're revealing sensitive information, information you deem sensitive to the state government, it seems to me the government is asking you for too much information, that they should be barred from asking you about information you don't want out in the public. Now, I'm sure a million people right now are getting ready to email us and tell us about all the exceptions to that hypothetical principle. But I'm just struck, David, even, you know, the Sacramento Bee editorial board, no friend of the of conservatives or Vince Fong.
That's why I had to log in, because it's behind a paywall. And because of Radio Free California, I have an account with SAC Bee. But it was, as I was doing it, I was thinking, wait a second, that headline and SAC Bee do not go together.
Yes, it does not. SACB's editorial board is notoriously left-wing, and I don't mean just like, you know, moderate
and
left.
Notoriously Newsom-ish.
Yes, very pro-Newsom. And their headline here is, in killing this bill, spoiler alert, the bill didn't survive first contact with legislative reality. It was shut down immediately with loads of abstentions and then a no vote of two Democrats or three Democrats. In killing this bill, California Democrats proved they're lapdogs for Governor Newsom. That's because Newsom does not want this bill. Newsom wants there to be NDAs allowed in the making of this sausage of legislation. Here's the lead from the story. On Thursday, that's last week, the State Assembly Democrats made a quick and quiet kill of a bill that would have banned non-disclosure agreements and legislation negotiations in a move that was conniving and obvious proof of an unapologetic cabal with narrow membership. You just need a D next to your name. David, that sounds like Fox News or Breitbart wrote that lead.
Mm-hmm.
Assembly Bill 2564, introduced by Assemblyman Vince Fong of Bakersfield, would have updated the state's Political Reform Act of 1974 by banning the use of non-disclosure agreements in crafting legislation for lobbyists, the governor's staff, a member of the legislature, any public official. It was a direct response to Gavin Newsom's Panera-gate debacle last month. So I'm all for a ban on NDAs, but I think what's still missing from this conversation is how the legislators themselves worked so closely with the Service Employees International Union, not just for that NDA deal, but that they threatened the fast food industry with basically a state takeover. They threatened to destroy their businesses. I am not kidding. They threatened to make corporations like McDonald's responsible for the activities of each of their franchisees, who are, of course, independent and separate businesses with a vendor contract with McDonald's. So they went directly after the corporate guys and said, nope, we're going to make you jointly liable for anything that goes on anywhere in any store that bears your brand name. So this was just absolute coercion from start to finish, and the NDA cover-up now for me from Gavin Newsom is amazing. And the only reason, I'm just going to say it, the only reason that SACB is truly interested in this is because reporters sometimes have a vestigial impulse to protect speech and openness and transparency.
Yeah, as they should.
Yes. But that's about the only time that we have this kind of Venn diagram overlap, I think, with folks like that. And I would also remind people that it was in 2021 that the left went crazy and Newsom signed a bill that said NDAs can no longer apply in the private sector. The ostensible reason was that women and people of color were being harmed.
Well, and I think we should be clear. I don't think they were banning all NDAs in all circumstances. They were seeking to put more fences around when they can be used.
Yes, and specifically around women who might be claiming harassment.
Right, which again, this is a great example. And again, I don't mind if legal minds with more experience in this and expertise than I have want to chime in or even disagree. But I immediately thought, as I do economically, about unintended consequences. They were saying a woman who signs an NDA in exchange for a settlement after coming forward with something, the NDA can no longer be applicable.
Right.
And all I could think was, okay, well, what they're saying is they don't want a woman to have to be hushed over a bad thing that happened.
Mm.
And even if she's voluntarily signing it, mm-hmm. they're not going to allow it. But then what does that mean going forward? See, I think that apart from the ability to put something behind them to secure some discretion, sometimes because there's a difference of opinion, they mm-hmm. don't want to litigate.
Mm-hmm.
There are plenty of appropriate uses of an NDA. An NDA is a power move mm-hmm. and just saying, hey, we raped you and we're just going to pay you to go away and you can't talk about right. it. Ha ha. I'm against that, but yeah. also because I was against the underlying crime.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, this is my favorite bit with Norm MacDonald talking to Seinfeld about Bill Cosby. And he goes like, I don't get all these people. They say, you know, the worst part was the hypocrisy. And I say, like, I thought the worst part was the raping. Like, as if someone just came out and said, like, hey, I don't want to be a hypocrite. I'm planning on raping you. And they'd be like, oh
okay. Well, that's all right.
That's a good
Thank
guy.
God.
Yeah. But yeah, I think that, that probably banning NDAs, even in that case, potentially ended up having unintended consequence that hurts victims of abuse.
Well, I think what was fascinating was at the time the law was proposed by two women who had sued. They were going to sue Pinterest. And then Pinterest came forward and said, like, look, we don't acknowledge any of your fact claims, but we don't want to litigate, so we're going to pay you some cash. I still don't know how much. I'm sorry that I wasn't able to find that number, but we're going to pay you money, and you're going to agree not to try to litigate this in the court of public opinion. The ladies said, fine, they signed the deal, they took the money, and they went immediately to the California State Legislature, proposed a bill that would allow them to escape from the contract they had signed with Pinterest. And now Pinterest was terribly ashamed because, of course, a lot of its clients are women, I assume. I mean, I don't spend any time on Pinterest, but I thought it was for ladies who like to crochet and that.
Oh, yeah. It's got to be, what, 80-20, 90-10?
I would imagine. Yeah.
In my life, 100-0.
Yeah, exactly. So it's, you know, but it, the idea that you can sign an agreement.
Although I hear Augustine has a lot of fans on Pinterest.
It's mostly those little pillows where you sign things, like, why did I steal the pears? All right. Hey, and more Gavin Newsom news. Here's the headline. Newsom celebrates storage milestone, but confirms blackouts are not over yet. This was an April 25th story.
I love it. It's when Gavin Newsom talks about blackouts.
It's so great. Yeah.
It never gets old.
Gavin Newsom's out in Yolo County because you only live once. And a reporter, and he's out there to show that, you know, things are going great. Look at it. He says, battery storage is foundational. He means foundational to this kind of new clean energy. And again, stipulations, air quotes around clean. It's not clean. We'll talk about that in a sec. But he's there to brag about the fact that there's now a lot of battery storage in Yolo County to collect solar-generated electricity. And a reporter asks if, quote, this accomplishment could spell the end of California's blackouts. But Newsom quickly turned attention to Texas, describing Lone Star State's blackout issues as severe because of the unpredictable nature of oil and gas and extreme weather. Well, we've talked about that on the show. It wasn't because of oil and gas. It was because clean energy was shut down, including gas and others. This is our biggest power source in California. He's talking about clean energy and renewables. That's our biggest source. Well, that's because the government has tried to shut down all fossil fuels and nuclear. Significantly bigger, he goes on, than the last remaining nuclear plant. But no, this is not today announcing that blackouts are part of our past. But we just want to do everything we can to mitigate that. So we're going to have all these battery storage units because we need clean energy. And the same week, David, I just want to point out that the Democratic Republic of Congo has accused Apple of purchasing cobalt for batteries and other kinds of mechanisms that Apple uses and others do, produced with slave labor. So that's the Democratic Republic of Congo coming after a California-based corporation, you might have heard of it, called Apple. And then most cobalt in the world comes from China, which has been accused of using children and prisoners to mine cobalt, or the Democratic Republic of Congo. The UN has now created a new group called the Panel on Critical Energy Transition Minerals. All of this does not portend well for the governor's claims that this is all clean energy. This stuff is filthy, and it's produced in some of the most benighted places in the world. And I'm talking about China and the DRK, the Democratic Republic of Congo. I'm sorry, that's C, not K. That would be Korea. So, long story short, we've got the governor bragging about batteries and how great they are and battery storage. We're going to have clean energy. And I just want to keep reminding myself and perhaps anybody listening to this that there is no such thing as clean energy. Everything, as Thomas Sowell says, is a trade-off.
It's always been true. It's particularly true with energy.
This is a message from our friends at American Habits from the State Policy Network. We the people, do you ever think about what that means and what happened to it? We the people certainly did not mean an imperial city full of unelected bureaucrats deciding everything from kindergarten curricula to nursing home funding formulas. We the people mean self-government, a free people deciding most things in their families and communities and delegating some authority to their towns and states while passing along just a small amount of that power to the national government. How did things get so upside down? At American Habits, we tell stories of real people with real solutions, all working to restore federalism and self-government. If you're a public official, come get involved. If you're a citizen, come and see the new standard for American leadership. No matter who you are, come help us renew the forgotten but not lost habit of American self-government. Visit AmericanHabits.org to learn more. That's AmericanHabits.org.
Hey, very quickly, I just wanted to talk about Planned Parenthood. Northern California workers unionized with SEIU, Local 1021. And here's the lead from, I think this was San Francisco Chronicle. Workers for Planned Parenthood in Northern California have unionized after more than 75% of the workers there voted to join SEIU. The workers, now known as Planned Parenthood NorCal Workers United, began organizing in December, publicly announced plans to form a union in January. Now they have that union. I just want to point out that here's what's happening. Why did the workers say they now need a union? They need a union at Planned Parenthood because they're overworked. They're performing so many abortions. Here's one of them. Kim Delhonte, this is in a KQED report. She's a Santa Rosa-based reproductive health specialist who is now part of the union, said her work is seeing an increase in patients from other states who are no longer able to get access to the care they need, with heavy patient loads and often 1 or 2 hour wait times. These clients from other states are looking for abortion services, particularly. And Planned Parenthood provides those, and so does Gavin Newsom and SEIU. So SEIU pushes for more abortion, expansion of abortion rights or access to abortion. Newsom signs off on the bill. When people from other states come here to take advantage of those expanded abortion rights, remember that Newsom is inviting people to come from all over the United States and, in fact, all over the world. This is not we do not check for your residency status, your citizenship. Don't care what state you live in. We will give you a free abortion. So when those people show up in droves to get abortions in California's Planned Parenthood centers, the workers say, hey, look, we're overwhelmed. And SEIU conveniently steps in and says, gee, well, that's terrible for you. You need a union. So on the one hand, let's push for expanded abortion care, make it free, make the taxpayers pay for it. And then when the Planned Parenthood workers, staffers complain that they're being overwhelmed, SEIU is going to offer them worker protections. And SEIU will try to unionize these people, as it did here, collect money from them, and then run candidates for public office who get into office if they win and return the favor to SEIU in the form of like fast food minimum wages that SEIU wanted or expanded abortion rights, etc. So this is just a quick story about how the money machine works in California politics, the just absolute legal corruption at the heart of the system. Hey, I want to talk to you about two stories from the Central Valley, David. One is that the Wonderful Nurseries, that's their name. I'm not suggesting that's an adjective for the nurseries. They're wonderful. But most workers there seem to think they're fantastic because they have sued United Farm Workers for what they say are fraudulent union claims and illegal discrimination. According to a couple of workers who are now being represented by our friends at National Right to Work, the wonderful company's nursery, these workers have filed charges against UFW. They say the UFW agents fraudulently obtained membership cards for employees and later used these as a basis to demand monopoly bargaining power over Wonderful's employees all over the state. Some great stories here about how this happened. One of the workers says that UFW people came through door knocking and approached individual employees, and they asked them, would you like a $600 COVID-19 stimulus check? They explained eventually that if you signed the card, you would get the money. So a lot of workers not being literate in English, perhaps. That's a thing here that the workers are alleging, that a lot of their workers don't speak English well, and a few of them can't read. Sign these cards because they were told, all you got to do is sign this card and you'll get $600. Now, the union, UFW, we've talked about them last week with Cesar Chavez and Dolores Huerta. That organization has become absolutely corrupt. We'll talk about them again in just a moment. But the UFW says, absolutely not, never happened. And in fact, we think the people who own the Wonderful Nurseries are the corrupt actors here. They're clearly behind workers' protests. Now, workers are actually protesting outside the plant and saying, we don't want this union. Please don't negotiate with them. And the Wonderful Nurseries are trapped between the workers, the union, the state law. They are almost unable to do anything to help their own employees escape this. They have to maintain a kind of rigorous neutrality, even though this clearly damaged this union effort, clearly, I think, impinges on their freedom to work. Mm. Can you talk to me, David, about another story, Wall Street Journal? This involves a friend of the show, Dan Growen, who sold his company up in the Central Valley, a company called Prima Wawona. He sold it to a private equity firm, and I'll just read real quickly here. It says, this is from the Wall Street Journal headline, Prima Wawona collapse shines a harsh light on private equity owner. Do you want me to read the lead, or do you want to just jump in?
Go ahead and read it, but then, yeah, I'd love to chime in a bit.
Sure. So Dan Grauman sells his firm to this company called Payne Schwartz Partners, and his company was one of the largest U.S. growers of peaches and plums, but now they're having to liquidate everything in Chapter 11 bankruptcy. The journal story says its private equity owner, that's Payne Schwartz Partners, blames setbacks from wildfires and disease outbreaks, but critics say Payne Schwartz mishandled its investment in the company, which they bought in 2019 by combining Grauman Farming and Wawona Packing, two California growers that had been led for decades by family owners. So the Wall Street Journal's take on this is private equity just can't do this, really. They can't get involved in farming.
Can't do what?
They can't get involved in agriculture because agriculture requires a unique kind of, you're already smiling, requires a kind of unique magical touch that no private equity firm, and that's where I start to feel like there's a kind of a vagueness in the claims against private equity in general. Yeah. Rather than what's possible, bad management in this one particular firm and this investment in particular. But it's much broader than that. The journal story, and I've long since given up my sense that the journal's news pages are run by, you know, people who understand free markets or business, really.
Well, on a relative basis, they're doing pretty well.
They're better. Yeah. But it's their, you know, it's their commentary pages, I think, that are extraordinary. But the newsroom is now more, has come to represent, I think, more progressive views. And so this just strikes me as kind of a punch in the head of all private equity. And, you know, no private equity firm could ever manage this kind of a, you know, agrarian farmer, blood and soil kind of business model. What's your sense of what's going on here?
Well, you know what's interesting? And again, I read the article a couple weeks ago when it first came out, and in rereading it this morning or last night, I still don't think that they necessarily drew a conclusion as to what they're suggesting should happen or not happen. Like when they say, well, this is private equity's fault, or private equity is something bad, I don't get the impression they're saying, therefore, we need like a Liz Warren like a Liz Warren conclusion of let's have the state ban it. Mm-hmm. I'm always, because I'm such a Hayekian, I always get a kick out of someone saying they just can't understand X. In this case, X is agriculture. Mm-hmm. Generally, the people who have the biggest vested interest in saying someone can't understand X are the people that currently are making the money from X. And want to make sure that, you know, A, B, and C are always left out of X. But there are obviously industries that have certain nuance and time and place circumstances and issues that some people would not understand either as operators or investors. I mean, that happens all the time. So you say, well, what do we do about it? I am absolutely convinced, having looked at this particular event, that it speaks to some extremely poor management from the people who did buy and made, you know, particular decisions that have obviously proven to be unwise and damaging in one of the biggest understatements I could possibly offer. But my question would be, for those who want to draw the conclusion, therefore, let's keep private equity out of agriculture, what they want to do with the counterfactuals. Can I see that for a second?
Please. Mm-hmm.
Because one of my favorite pieces was, give me one second here, referring to the challenge specific with this product, they say, I know I'm going to find it, so just give me a moment here.
He's coming. David is actually looking at a hard copy. I haven't seen you actually hold paper and look at it closely.
I'm very blind.
It's coming.
Say something interesting.
Well, I think that one of the things they say is right there that I had underlined, that one of the reporters' lines is specifically that private equity can't deal with things like weather and fluctuations in fertility, perhaps, or, you know, just climate in general, causes this to be a unique business that no private equity firm can really manage.
It says it raises questions about whether a private equity model, which has debt, they're trying to get short-term efficiency and expansion, works when there's unpredictable farming operations. And my question is, at a high level, what is a business that doesn't have unpredictable something? Now, I agree that what farming has that's unpredictable is different than what other businesses have. But then they go on to say, and again, this particular here was about peaches and plums. There are plenty of examples of private equity transacting with agriculture businesses and having incredibly successful outcomes.
Yeah.
So you get to look at a bad example and you decide, is this systemic? And by the way, is it systemic, meaning it affects everyone, not just the parties in a transaction? And what is the side effect of what's going to happen if we try to ban private equity from buying a certain category of company? But when they say, we don't think private equity is able to really understand the challenges of farming or of agriculture, say, well, do you think the media does? And then let's go to the real example. Do you think the regulators do? So the people that are going to ban investors from being in the space don't understand it either, but they understand it enough to ban some people based on their lack of understanding from doing it.
Right.
So you end up forcing some unintended consequences that can be very, very bad. But what's really interesting is that the actual article makes the point, first of all, that the very fund here, who clearly screwed up this transaction profoundly, that then their next capital raise went out and exceeded their target. That this is Food Chain Fund 6. And so there are investors that apparently have had a result from other transactions that's causing them to reinvest.
They have confidence in the companies.
But like, I'm of the mindset that they screwed this thing up. Where is the deal? My question is, why would I think markets don't have the embedded mechanisms to deal with it? Like that next time a farming transaction be looked at differently, or a particular type of farming transaction, or the private equity buyer would have to make a case to a seller of like, here's what we learned from that last thing. We're going to do this instead of this. You know, not that, oh, we know that we have a way of predicting the weather and these other guys didn't, but just some form of risk management and whatnot. I just think that, you know, they say agricultural technology has attracted $204 billion of business since 2014. And that agriculture investment funds at $60 billion since July. This particular transaction seems to have lost quite a bit of money, but they're saying it's perishable fruit that is not always available to private equity. So really, you have to get past agriculture and farming to get very specific to nectarines. This is the specificity we want regulators to have in their micromanagement of the economy. It just doesn't make a lot of sense. Oh, and this is the line I was looking for about an hour and a half ago. Private equity firms have had success investing in crops such as cotton and corn and almonds. I'm sorry. Is that not a counterfactual, the whole article?
That would seem to be.
You're saying weather and the unpredictable of agriculture cycle makes these private equity guys. You know what it is? There's good private equity guys. There's bad private equity guys. There's good companies, bad companies. There's good deals, bad deals. This Payne Schwartz with this deal obviously screwed the pooch. That happens.
Yeah.
And I think that in this particular case, hopefully some heads roll and lessons learned and whatnot. You know, I don't want to get more into the specifics than that. My point being the idea of trying to say, therefore, a category of investor should be barred from a category of industry.
Yes.
There is one industry that will hurt if you do that. That is the industry you bar those investors from coming into.
Yes. That's right. Yeah, that's what strikes me about the story is that the specifics seem to be almost inarguable. It does seem like there was a screw up here, but that will be decided probably in court. A couple of lawsuits floating around out there, but that it's difficult to extrapolate from the failures of this specific deal to the broader category, I think is what you're saying.
Yeah, and where there are specific things here in this case to get to litigate, you know, I my hope is for some good guys to prevail and some bad guys to fail, because I kind of do think there are some things that went on here that need to be dealt with.
And the market will deal with that.
But it always does. Markets, you never want to interrupt price discovery. And you never want to create a fragility by not allowing, the system gets stronger with private equity than it is without it. Okay, because good deals get done, bad deals get done, and they all provide learning experiences. They provide basically the price mechanism. And there is absolutely no way anybody intuitively doesn't understand that deals are getting done because people believe they can make money, not because they go, oh, you know what? We don't know anything about this.
Let's try it anyway.
We're guaranteed to screw it up. And some reporter figured out that, like, we just, you know, are incapable of being able to do these deals. Well, or this company screwed up this deal. So.
Hey, there's a story that I'm just going to kind of flag here for listeners. I'll put it in the show notes. It's from the LA Times. And David, I thought this reminded me so much of your book, Full Time. It's a story in the LA Times by a very young reporter named Javier Martinez, who finds his grandfather's workbook in Oaxaca, Mexico. That's the far southern Yucatan state down there at the very bottom of Mexico. And his Oaxacan grandfather used to come to the U.S. in the 70s and 80s and 90s and make just marginal amounts of money, but save almost everything. And in this notebook, this young reporter finds in Oaxaca, the grandfather notates meticulously how much money he made from what kind of work, you know, laying wire or building a fence or picking cherries or whatever it might be in California, Washington, and Oregon. Just a fascinating story. But the key of it is that this grandfather sent huge amounts of money back to his family in Mexico and sustained them over generations, so that now that family has actually kind of got an accumulated wealth from this work. And what I draw from the story is the thrift, the hard work, the loyalty to family that is illustrated in this wonderful story, but also just how the farm work in America, which is routinely just denigrated by the far left as subhuman and evil and it's terrible and we got to regulate it more highly, that however bad that work is, it is often better than the work that people left behind to come here for, like this grandfather. So it's a longish story. I don't need to summarize the whole thing, but it is just a remarkable story of hard work, thrift, saving, and family loyalty in the LA Times. So,
love it.
Phenomenal story. Hey, do you want to do any letters? It is like 2 minutes before five, and I know you have to run off.
Do you want to do the one? Do you want to do a different one? What do you want?
Well, let's...
We don't have to read all that. You kind of corresponded.
Yeah, I did. We had a listener who was upset that we went on last week, I think it was, about USC, and I pointed out, you know, first of all, I just said, hey, look, sorry, USC ain't for everybody, but we were hardly celebrating USC when we spoke about their terrible mishandling of the valedictory speech.
We've been critical of that stuff all the time.
The
tone of that thing was more the typical thing, like, oh, you rich kids or frat boys or something. That kind of language got thrown out there a bit, and I always think it's kind of funny. Do people know I didn't go to USC?
You should explain.
I don't have anything to explain. I don't have a college degree at all.
But you have a
connection. I don't understand why I get branded as this sort of... Well, my dad definitely did go to USC and get a PhD in philosophy, and you know what frat boy, rich kids, those guys
That's
are.
That's where all the swingers go.
Yeah.
Mud hall.
I think that there's this sort of general, you know, thing people have that's more based on a stereotype than reality. But, I mean, we've talked about it a bunch, and not everyone hears everything that we say. Well, I didn't say anything last week about USC. I'm willing to take back, and I don't think we ever have on the podcast. It is a mantra that I hold dear, and I am a Trojan for life. I believe in the fight on spirit, and I believe in it so much that I hope USC itself will follow their own mantra and fight on to be a better institution than they often behave as. But saying like the Varsity Blues thing kind of made me laugh, because I don't understand. Someone trying to rip off the university is a weird example of the university. And then the issue we brought up was really about Reggie, where I fully stand by everything I said. I don't think that they did anything wrong whatsoever.
Yeah. Well, and you also had the great line about OJ. One of the greatest running backs in college football, 1967 to 68, and
both
then 30 years later, one of the most notorious murderers in America.
Yeah.
All right. Hey, I did an interview a couple days ago with Pacific Legal Foundation's Jack Brown. We talked about the impact of the Reparations Commission's study on the impacts of systemic racism in California and some solutions. Let's just go ahead, if you don't mind, and I'll ask Sarah to roll that tape in right here. All right, joining us now is Jack Brown of Pacific Legal Foundation. Jack, you got a BA in History and Ancient Greek and Roman Studies from the University of Delaware. I'm not telling you anything new. You were there. And you got your JD from George Mason University's Antonin Scalia Law School in 2019. You are, if I may so, from say so from my perspective, a very young man. Congratulations. Enjoy your youth. Welcome to the show, Jack.
Thanks very much for having me on. And thank you.
Such a pleasure. I want to talk about two issues today. They're you know, one is a legal complaint, and the other one is a bill moving through the state assembly. And both of them flow, Jack, I think you'll agree, from the sort of general ideological framework of critical race theory, systemic racism, and California's endeavor to repair racial injustice through a reparations committee's work. We've talked a lot about that on the show. But specifically, you've taken up a lawsuit on behalf of some friends of CPCs. That's Californians for Equal Rights, and it's a federal lawsuit. Here, I'm just reading here from your own notes on this. The San Diego Housing Commission launched the first-time homebuyer program for middle-income Black, Indigenous, people of color households in 2023. Is that the entire formal name of this thing?
Yeah, so it's a bit of a mouthful, but it's the Black, Indigenous, and Other People of Color First Time Home Buyer Program for middle income households, and it is quite the mouthful. But basically, the way that the program works is that it's a housing program that discriminates on the basis of race. So the city of So the city of San Diego is offering tens of thousands of dollars worth of these housing benefits. It's either in the form of a $20,000 loan combined with a $20,000 grant to assist with closing costs and a down payment, or just the $20,000 grant. But instead of providing these benefits to everyone, it's providing benefits to specific households on the basis of race, and specifically it's households that identify as any race other than white.
Tell us about your clients. I know Wenyin Wu over there at Californians for Equal Rights, great group of people, tend to be Asian American. And I'm wondering, does people of color no longer include Asian Americans? And even if it does, I'm delighted to see that Wenyin is, you know, and her organization still utterly consistent on making sure that racial qualifications don't enter into government calculations like this one.
So for the purposes of this program, Asian Americans would be considered people of color. They would be eligible for the program's benefits because they're not white. However, some of CFER, California's for Equal Rights Foundation, it is indeed a very consistent defender of this principle of equality under the law for all Californians. And while a lot of their leadership does consist primarily of Asian American individuals, some of their members are not Asian American. Some of them are white or Black or otherwise. So, and in particular, California's for Equal Rights basis for standing is that some of their members are indeed white and they would be eligible for the program. They meet all the income requirements and they haven't owned a home in the last 3 years. But because they're white, they're not eligible for the program. So CFER is sticking up for its members and trying to stop the city of San Diego from engaging in these discriminatory policies.
Like most Californians, I'm surprised by this in part because I know that California has since, I don't know, 1996 barred any kind of racial discrimination, even when it is in high-flying language, like, you know, we're here to redress historic grievances. How does this survive on first contact with constitutional reality in California?
So you're referring to Prop 209 or Article 1, Section 31 of the California Constitution, which imposes a hard ban on racial preferences in government, contracting, employment, and education. Now, the problem with that is that the California courts have limited that provision based on its text to just those three areas. So if the program in question or the discrimination in question doesn't deal with government, employment, education, or contracting, then Prop 209 just doesn't apply. And that's the case here. This is the housing program. So those three areas aren't implicated. However, the program still violates the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, and that's what provides the basis for this law.
And that's why you've taken the case to federal rather than state court.
That's part of the reason, yes. It's not the sole reason, but it's the main reason. There's no real need to bring it in California state court because that aspect of the California Constitution is implicated by it.
You say it's not the only reason. Are there other reasons for a federal rather than state solution?
The federal rules of civil procedure tend to be just a little bit simpler and less esoteric, shall we say, than state rules of civil procedure. That's not a knock on the California Code of Civil Procedure at all, but there's also a long-running joke among me and my colleagues that anyone who complains about the federal rules has never litigated in state court before. So it's just the federal rules are a bit more uniform, and since it wasn't necessary to bring the case in California state court, we figured we might as well do it in federal court.
So two quick questions then. Where are you in the process? You've, I guess, clearly filed the complaint. Where are you in that process? And maybe you can sort of lay out the next steps for us, you know, the timeline for the future. And then give us your sense of what your chances are here.
Sure. Well, with regard to where the case is now, the deadline for the defendants, which are the City of San Diego, the San Diego Housing Authority, and the San Diego Housing Commission to respond to the complaint is on May 1st. So that means they have until then to either file an answer to the complaint, in which case we'll basically just go into discovery to establish the facts on the ground about this program and the extent to which it discriminates on the basis of race and whether or not the city's discrimination can be justified. Or they could try to file a motion to dismiss, arguing that our complaint is deficient in some way, say, for example, lack of standing or something like that. But that's due on May 1st, and then from there, we'll be able to, if they want to file a motion to dismiss, we'll be able to file a response. And meanwhile, if they file an answer, I think it basically will just go to discovery, will be kind of the next major step in the case.
Okay, as so just, our, if I may just, if just so our listeners know sort of the chronology here, you and I are recording this on Friday, April the 26th. You were saying May 1st. I believe that's next Wednesday or Thursday. So by the time this show comes out, we might even have a response, you're saying, from the San Diego Housing Commission.
Yes.
Okay. And then on your, tell us about what you think your chances are. I know that's like asking a football coach right before he goes into the game.
Well, I think that our chances are very, very good in this case. And that's because even though there are technically some forms of race-based treatment under current court precedent that are permissible under the Equal Protection Clause, any kind of race-based treatment or racial discrimination still has to satisfy what the courts call strict scrutiny. And what that means is that the city in this case has the burden of establishing before the courts that they have a compelling interest in their racial discrimination, and they also have to prove that the discrimination is narrowly tailored to fulfill that compelling interest. And here they really fail on both counts, because under the current precedent, the only compelling interest for any kind of race-based measure like this is that they need to be remedying specific instances of past discrimination. It's not enough to just say there's been discrimination in the housing market in the past. You have to show that the city and the housing commission have actually been engaged in this kind of racial discrimination and that the program in question is an attempt to remedy that. And it also has to be narrowly tailored using the least restrictive means possible to address the problem. So it's not enough that you've established that there's past racial discrimination, you also have to show that any kind of race neutral alternative is not going to be enough to fix the problem. And it also can't be overbroad. Now here, not only do they not really have any specific instances of past discrimination in the housing market by the city and the housing commission that they're trying to fix, but at the same time, it's also not narrowly tailored and it's overbroad because there's no evidence that every single non-white racial group that's benefiting from this program has experienced that discrimination in the past. So either way, it's going to fail strict scrutiny, and I like our chance for it.
It sounds, if I understand you correctly, as if the commission has to first make a thorough, full-throated apology for its past, let's just call it prejudicial behavior with regard to race, its past racist behavior. And we have to be very specific about those. That would require a kind of Catholic act of confession. You know, on this date and with regard to these very specific people, we did these terrible things. Is, if that's correct, you're saying they're not likely to offer that?
I don't think so, no. It would effectively be tantamount to admitting that they've engaged in illegal discrimination in the past, which I don't think is terribly likely.
No, I don't think they'd like that look either. Right. New city motto, right? Let's move on to something else that's going on over there. That's your colleague, Andrew Kineo. I'm so sorry, Kineo. Showed up in the Capitol the other day to talk about, to testify about Assembly Bill 2862, which would require that the issuance of occupational and professional licenses be based on race and ancestry, specifically African Americans, would receive priority in licensure, especially descendants of enslaved persons, individuals of any other race. I'm reading directly from your notes here again. Individuals of any other race seeking a license would be pushed to the back of the line. AB 2862, you write, is unconstitutional as drafted and undermines equality and opportunity. Again, this is an assembly bill that cites as its, evidentiary necessity, the work of the state's reparations commission. And again, flows out of this idea, this philosophy that really, California has been engaged in systemic racism for so long that this is one of the only likely remedies. And I just want to remind our listeners that, among the other asks from the Reparations Commission was $1.2 million payments to descendants of African-American slaves, no matter where they were enslaved, because they weren't enslaved in California. California was a free state from the very beginning in 1850. But with cash being a little short these days in Sacramento, thank you, Governor Newsom, progressives have really turned to kind of non-monetary sorts of solutions for reparations. And this is the kind of thing that we're likely to see a lot of this year. That is not a cash payment, but just a kind of a helping hand, if you will, an affirmative action sort of policy. And this one pushes African Americans who can prove their descent from slaves to the front of the line in licensing their various occupations. Tell us why, again, I'll just ask you the same question I did with regard to the San Diego case. How would this even meet any reasonable standard? This says that, again, it seems to violate California state law, seems to violate federal law, equal protection. How does this thing survive first contact with reality?
Well, it really doesn't survive first contact with reality, because again, it violates the 14th Amendment's Equal Protection Clause because it fails strict scrutiny. So it's not, it doesn't fulfill a compelling interest because the state is not identifying specific instances of discrimination in licensing that it's trying to fix. It's effectively taking a shotgun approach of saying, if you're within this specific racial group, then you just get a preference for being chosen to have this occupational license. And for that matter, it's also not narrowly tailored because they are not specifically addressing they're not specifically addressing past instances, and also they are also running into an issue where they have other race-neutral alternatives that they haven't considered. So, for example, if occupational licensing is overly burdensome in California, which it absolutely is for all racial groups, not just Black Americans, one thing that they could do is just reduce the licensing burden and have fewer professions be licensed. As it stands in California currently, 1 in 6 Californians require some kind of occupational license to do their job. That's 2 million people. And for many of those professions, those are lower income professions that don't require any form of higher education and that really shouldn't need this kind of barrier of entry to work in that field. But
These are occupations like, I'm just going to guess, nail salons, hair braiders, barbers, maybe like that, you can think of others. But these tend to be sort of very entry-level jobs in America, places where people can kind of climb on that first rung of the or second rung of the economic ladder and go to work, except for the regulatory obstacles that are placed in their path by this kind of licensing. And you're suggesting, I think, really innovatively, the solution is a wholesale reform of the licensing process and perhaps even just eliminating license requirements. I'm not terribly concerned that the state licenses the person who, maybe my wife would kill me for this, but getting her nails done, that just seems like a real low risk sort of activity. And I'm also not confident the state is really looking over the shoulder of people in a nail salon or a barber shop or any other place. I love your idea that it's really about time to reform the entire occupational licensing process rather than try to just add on this new additional obstacle to low-income people and say, no, Black people get first preference on these things.
Right, absolutely. The worst thing that happens to you if you have a bad barber is, you get a bad haircut, and from there, Yelp can kind of sort everything out. If bad barbers or bad nail salon operators are really such a problem, letting Yelp or other online review sites handle the problem strikes me as a much more effective way of dealing with the problem than licensure. And that also has the added benefit of allowing lower income people to enter these professions and improve their livelihoods. Again, that's not the only race neutral alternative the state could employ. Another thing that they could do is just look at people who have in fact faced racial discrimination when applying for the license and help those people. That's a much more narrowly tailored way of addressing this problem than just imposing a racial preference. And the state just hasn't done that here. So it's the law in question, the bill fails strict scrutiny.
I hate to put you on the spot like this. I did not prep you for this next question. Take a deep breath. I want to take you back to the University of Delaware, your undergrad years there. You're studying Roman classic. We used to call them the classical studies or something like that, Roman and Greek history. Do you observe, and most men we now know are supposed to be thinking about Rome at least once a day. I think it is. I can't remember. You're probably thinking about it more frequently than most of us. But I wonder, when you think back to those days and you recall your studies, what do you think about when you think about Roman and Greek empires and America, where we are today, and perhaps even more specifically California, which does seem to me like an empire in decline, capable of great recovery and promise if we just liberate our people. But for the moment, we suffer under a kind of heavy-handed regulatory government right now. I hesitate to call it socialist, but it sure seems to be moving in that direction. So what do you think when you think about California, the U.S., Rome, Greece?
Well, there's certainly a parallel between California in particular and America overall when you're comparing it to the Roman Empire starting in sort of the late second century and going into the third century, because one of the biggest problems that faced the Roman Empire during that period was overspending. Now, in Rome, the real issue was overspending on their military, because that was what they spent the lion's share of their budget on. And in the year 193, when Septimius Severus came to power, he basically seized power as a military dictator. What happened was that the previous emperor, Pertinax, had been assassinated by the Praetorian Guard, which kicked off this massive civil war, and Severus sort of came out on top. And he recognized that he derived his power from the soldiers, and he started spending more and more money on soldier pay and on the military to make sure that he kept them happy, because he knew that if they became unhappy, he was not going to be emperor for much longer. Eventually, though, the soldiers got wise to this as well. So what happened was that whenever the emperor would not accede to their demands, they would just assassinate the emperor and replace him with someone else. That kicked off a period in Rome called the Crisis of the Third Century, where they went through 26 emperors in 50 years, which is on average one emperor every 2 years. And it really created this period of instability and massive political crisis that they never really fully recovered from. They bounced back a bit during the reigns of Diocletian and Constantine, but they never quite fully recovered from it. And that, of course, left them vulnerable to barbarian invasions later on. So California definitely has a spending problem, as does the United States. And it doesn't seem like most of our leaders from either party are terribly interested and terribly willing to address the problem or fix it in any way. They just keep wanting to kick the can down the road. So I certainly find that concerning as a student of Roman history.
I am absolutely amused and amazed. I did not prompt this answer from you. It is highly detailed and wonderful. Great specifics. Thank you, Jack Brown, attorney for the Pacific Legal Foundation, out here defending freedom in California. Thank you so much, Jack. That's all we have time today. Thanks for spending your time with us. You can always find Radio Free California on the National Review website. But remember, it would be easier for you and far better for us if you just subscribe. And of course, rate and review the show wherever you do subscribe. That boosts our profile and that helps others find and join this band of brothers and sisters. Email us your comments and story suggestions. You'll find our email addresses in the show notes. On behalf of my friend and co-host David Bonson, guest attorney Jack Brown, we give thanks as ever to session producers Lucas Klaus, Brian Tong, Glenn Hall, and National Review podcast producer Sarah Schutte. Thanks also to Metalachi, that Seattle-based mariachi and metal band, for our music. And say it with me, La Revolución continúa la semana próxima. Adios.